Okay. Friends and colleagues, welcome to this NIAC Virtual Talks, International Arbitration, America and Abroad. It has been over 1 year since we last met together in New York, and 2 years since Gary delivered his keynote at NIAC. We appreciate that each of you continues to register and to attend sessions like this one, as life runs in parallel from your home office or otherwise. Many auspicious moments have passed in the pandemic. Today, please also join me in extending wishes of Eid Mubarak to those breaking the fast of Ramadan. It is my great pleasure to welcome Gary Bourne to NIAC's virtual stage. Gary is chair of the International Arbitration Practice Group at Wilmer, Cutler, Pickering, Hale, and Dorr, a NIAC founding firm in the London office, which he is beaming in from now. Gary wears many hats. As president of the SIAC Court of Arbitration, as visiting an honorary academic at several leading law schools, and as member of NIAC's Global Advisory Board, in addition to numerous esteemed roles across organizations and institutions. I also note in celebration recent editions of Gary's works published earlier this year that include the third edition of International Commercial Arbitration and the sixth edition of International Arbitration and Forum Selection Agreements. More on Gary can be found on his well-curated Wikipedia page, in addition to his Wilmer Hale page. I'll also introduce now our interlocutor, who will interview Gary following his keynote. Aaron Thomas is a partner at Covington & Burling, a NIAC founding firm in the New York office. She focuses her practice on representing clients in complex international disputes, both in commercial and investor state. Erin also maintains an active pro bono caseload and regularly speaks at conferences. Her recent firm alert covering cutting-edge issues and legal guidance discussed anticipating legal and business implications of the military coup in Myanmar. Finally, I extend my thanks to the City Bar's Arbitration and Inter-American Affairs Committee, and specifically to Steve Skolnick and Michael Fernandez for co-sponsoring this event, and to Dominique Jones, a student at Columbia Law, who graciously assists me in the operations of today's program. Two administrative items. Please posit your questions in the Q&A function as they percolate during the keynote or thereafter. And please do join us for networking and bring your own cocktails via separate Zoom meeting link after the substantive session. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Gary. Gary, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Rika. And thanks also, of course, to both NIAC and the New York City Bar committees who have so graciously agreed to both invite me and to sponsor this virtual lecture. Thanks also, of course, to Aaron and Dominic for taking their time on this. Most importantly, perhaps, so thanks to all of you watching from, I understand, from Rika, all around the world. It's a pleasure, it's an honor to be able to speak with you tonight about, or this morning, depending on where you are, about a topic that is so dear to my heart. The topic today is, of course, international arbitration. International arbitration with a historical perspective, but focused, given NIAC's platform for this event, on America, the United States, but also the Americas more generally, and abroad. Given that this is a historical discussion, as well as a discussion about present circumstances and, to some extent, predictions of the future, I'll start not with America, international arbitration. Arbitration didn't begin in America, although, as we're going to see, America has played a pivotal, essential role in the development of international arbitration. We'll start, though, with international arbitration elsewhere. And moving through the slides, we can begin, in fact, more than 4,500 years ago. The next slide shows two images which tell us where arbitration really began. The image on the left part of your screen is the stele of the vultures. It's a stone from what was then Mesopotamia, today southern Iraq. And the stone marker fixed the border between two warring Mesopotamian states, Uma and Lagash. The stone was fixed as a consequence of an arbitration, which was decided by the king of a neighboring state. Arbitration used in the first glimmers of prehistory to resolve the most fundamental types of dispute war between neighboring city-states. The image on the right-hand part of the slide is arbitration being used around the same time, also in Iraq, but northern Iraq, near what today is Kirkuk, near the Kurdistan region. An arbitration, a commercial arbitration between two neighboring landowners, Kili and Tulpanaya, who disagreed about the allocation of water between their respective land. The arbitrator decided, and the cuneiform tablet that you can see on the screen records the decision, that Kili would be awarded 10 silver shekels and an ox. Arbitration, though, being used in the very beginning of recorded history, 4,600 years ago or so, to resolve ordinary commercial disputes. Jumping ahead, and given the hour, we do need to move swiftly. Jumping ahead some 2,000 years to, backing up a slide, to 400 BC or so, we have two images from around that time period, again, representing domestic disputes and interstate disputes. On the left-hand part of the slide, and this really does reflect the ancient roots of arbitration and also how arbitration has been used historically to resolve all manner of human disputes. The image on the left is from Menander's play called The Arbitration. It was about a domestic dispute, claims of infidelity and the like, producing an arbitration which thankfully resolved the disputing couple's disagreements. On the right-hand part of the slide, moving to more public affairs, so to speak, an excerpt from Thucydides, and in particular, his description of the inclusion of arbitration clauses in city-state agreements, city-state treaties, where, in this case, Athens and Sparta agreed to submit future disputes under their peace treaty to arbitration. Arbitration to be conducted not by what we would know as an arbitrator, but instead by a neutral city. The next, moving forward another 1,000 years or so, to 1516 or thereabouts, the perpetual peace treaty between France on the one hand and the Swiss cantons, the Swiss Confederation on the other hand. The two parties, as part of their treaty of perpetual peace, agreeing to submit all future disputes instead of to arms, instead of to conflict, to arbitration by four arbitrators, two to be chosen by each side, and then the presiding arbitrator to be chosen either by agreement between the parties or through a complicated list selection process. Moving on through the slides and coming a little bit closer to the present day, the laws recorded in the Annals of Rochester from the Anglo-Saxon times, one of the first arbitration statutes, the law of Hiothir and Edric, whereby arbitration agreements were made valid and enforced through the inclusion of a penalty mechanism, 12 shillings in the event that one failed to honor one's agreement to arbitrate. In this case, the agreements relating to criminal matters. And thus, we've seen in the space of some 3,000 years or so, arbitration used in all parts of the world to resolve all manner of human disputes, a natural mechanism that people of every culture, every era have turned to for the resolution of their disputes, civil, criminal, interstate, and otherwise. Moving along and coming now closer to what most of us do, international commercial arbitration, the medieval trade fairs in Europe, where arbitration was routinely used because of its ability to efficiently resolve disputes between merchants. And this was well captured by, on the next slide, one of the classic works from the 17th century, Gerard Malines, who wrote a book on Lex Mercatore, and is worth having regard because we're going to come back on several occasions to this text in the course of this lecture, is worth having regard to exactly how he described arbitration. He described it as an ordinary course of means to end the questions and controversies arising between merchants by way of arbitrament, when both parties do make choice of honest men or women to end their causes, which is voluntary and in their own power and therefore called arbitrium or free will, a point we'll come back to, whence the name arbitrator is derived. And these men and women, by some called good men, proud hum, as in the French-Swiss treaty, or good women, give their judgments by awards according to equity and conscience, observing the customs of merchants, and ought to be void of all partiality or affection, more nor less to the one than to the other, having only care that right may take place according to the truth, and that the difference may be ended with brevity and expedition. Now, that language is, although couched in Middle English in a sense, not exactly the way we would put it today, but the substance is extraordinarily similar to how we today would describe arbitration. And indeed, as we're going to see later in this presentation, the underlying conception of arbitration as free will is one that holds as true today as it did in the 1600s in England in the European trade fairs. Moving along, and also crossing the Atlantic. This is one of the first U.S. decisions in coming to the America part of this presentation involving arbitration. It was a Delaware state court decision from well before the Declaration of Independence, where two arbitrators appointed to decide the party's dispute would, in the case of non-agreement, choose a third person as an umpire to make a final end thereof. Arbitration agreements being used at the very beginnings of the United States, the at that time United Colonies or disunited colonies, as the case may be, to resolve commercial disputes. Moving along. And 100 years later or so, in that well-known publication, the New York Weekly Postboy from May 1751, one party, and again, this reflects how arbitration was widely used by the colonists, perhaps wary of British courts. One litigant told the other, if you will not consent, perhaps now, to submit the matter in dispute to reference, that meant arbitration at the time, but let me tell you that after you have expended large sums of money and squandered away a deal of time and attendance on your lawyers and preparations for hearings one term after another, you will probably be of another mind and be glad 7 years hence to leave it to that arbitration which you now refuse. Again, sentiments expressed in the 18th century, but ones that you could very well hear from litigants, perhaps not put in a letter to the editor in the New York Weekly Postboy, but from litigants today. Moving along through American history, an insurance policy from the 1790s, shortly after the Revolution and the Constitution, whereby it was agreed that if any dispute arose under the policy, it should be referred to two indifferent persons. Part of the basic conception of arbitration that we saw both in Malines's description and subsequently, one to be chosen by the assured and the other by the assurer. And again, that mechanism of selecting arbitrators, the parties having the right to choose the arbitrators, each party in a fairly simple mechanism, choosing one arbitrator. And then those two who shall have the full power to adjust the dispute, decide the dispute. But in case they cannot agree, then such two persons shall choose a third, and any two of them agreeing shall be obligatory to both parties, a mechanism for constituting the arbitral tribunal in a 1793 insurance policy that was little different from what we saw centuries before in European contexts and which is used every day in institutional and ad hoc contexts today. moving along and still focusing on the United States, moving from the types of commercial disputes that we've seen in a very real sense. Arbitration was key, was perhaps not essential. We can't necessarily say that, but certainly present at the very conception of what is the United States. The Articles of Confederation coming into effect first in 1781, the precursor to the U.S. Constitution, contained within them, rather than mechanism for a Supreme Court, a mechanism for resolving disputes between states. That mechanism, unsurprisingly, was arbitration. In the event two states disagreed, which in those days happened with surprising frequency, the means to resolve that dispute was through what was effectively arbitration under the auspices of the Continental Congress. Again, a complex list system being used to provide a means to select the arbitral tribunal. This also, moving to the next slide, was perhaps a little surprisingly actually used and actually essential to ensuring the peace that ultimately led to the Constitution itself. Connecticut and Pennsylvania actually went to war. The Pennamite-Yankee Wars over something called the Wyoming Valley, which wasn't at all in today's Wyoming, but rather was what was in the western parts of today's Pennsylvania. That war, which extended over several decades, ultimately was resolved by arbitration. Arbitration conducted pursuant to the arbitral mechanism in the Articles of Confederation. The colonists, looking at the very time that they had obtained their independence from the British, to arbitration as the essential means for resolving their own interstate disputes. Moving along to the next slide, arbitration wasn't just present at the beginning of the Republic to resolve domestic disputes, but also, importantly, international disputes. A central element of the peace treaty that conferred independence on the United States, at least in the eyes of the world, was U.S. recognition of valid debts owed to British creditors by American debtors. U.S. courts could have done a little better in recognizing those treaty obligations. And ultimately, in Jay's treaty, which you can see on the current slide, an arbitral mechanism was established to ensure that the British creditors were fully compensated for the money that they had lent but not recovered from American entrepreneurs. At the same time, the Jay's Treaty also established a mechanism whereby Americans who had been wrong, ships destroyed, property destroyed by the British forces during the War of Independence could be resolved. And hundreds of awards were made in both directions under Jay's Treaty. It was essential, though, to solving the lingering issues that had led to the War of Independence. Moving along, arbitration also used in the most domestic of matters by George Washington. This is an excerpt of his will. And it's worth looking closely at the language that he used. He hoped very much that those who inherited from him would not fall to disputes, but that if any disputes unhappily should arise, they shall be decided by three impartial and intelligent men or women, known for their probity and good understanding, two to be chosen by the disputants, each having the choice of one and the third by those two, which three people thus chosen shall, unfettered by law or legal construction, declare their sense of the testator's intention, and such decision is to all intents and purposes to be as binding on the parties as if it had been given by the Supreme Court of the United States, the father in a very real sense of the United States, looking to arbitration to solve disputes arising out of his final act, his last will and testament, rather than conferring on national courts, on U.S. courts, the Supreme Court, or otherwise the power to do so. Moving along. And of course, arbitration being used by the United States to resolve another lingering difficulty with Great Britain. This is the argument in the Alabama arbitration between the United States and Great Britain, conducted after the Civil War, when the successful Union, the victorious Union, disappointed by British violations or alleged violations of neutrality, demanded reparations from Britain, a substantial amount of money for Britain's having outfitted or permitting private parties to have outfitted cruisers on British in British ports, which subsequently preyed on Union shipping, with the effect that, at least in the eyes of the United States, the Civil War had been prolonged by months, perhaps years, and hundreds of ships had been lost as a consequence of the British violations of neutrality. The British, of course, had a very different view of the matter. And ultimately, the disagreements between the United States and the United Kingdom were submitted to a 5-person arbitral tribunal. Unsurprisingly, one arbitrator chosen by each of the two sides, and the remaining 3 selected by agreement. The tribunal ultimately rendered an award in favor of the United States following a 6-month process in Geneva. If one visits Geneva, one can still go to the Hotel de Ville and see the room where the Alabama arbitration was conducted. It was successful, notwithstanding a dissenting opinion by the English appointed arbitrator. He also concluded that the United Kingdom should honor its obligations under the award, which it promptly did, resolving as well the disagreements between the United States and the United Kingdom. Arbitration was central, moving on to the next slide, to many aspects of U.S. policy towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. This is the Nobel Peace Prize conferred on Elihu Root in 1912. He received the Nobel Peace Prize because of his energetic affirmation of arbitration treaties, bilateral arbitration treaties between states aimed at ensuring that, like the United States and the United Kingdom in the Alabama arbitration, they would resolve their disputes by arbitration as opposed to by force or by resort to arms. His acceptance speech, ultimately not delivered, for the Nobel Peace Prize, urged states around the world to both enter into bilateral arbitration treaties of that nature, sometimes called the Taft treaties, and also to use arbitration, whether under those treaties or otherwise, to resolve interstate disputes. Moving along. And relatedly, this is the Peace Palace, and it's also the mural on the right-hand part of the slide of the Peace Palace in The Hague. It connects as well, although being in Europe, and in a sense, The Hague is one of the international legal capitals of the world, it was the result of American business. Andrew Carnegie donated the funds necessary to build the Peace Palace and to maintain it for posterity. The mural on the right-hand part of the slide is called today Arbitration and Justice. It is in the main courtroom of the International Court of Justice, which now sits in the Peace Palace. Interestingly, though, and in a sense this may introduce the next slightly discordant theme of this talk, interestingly, the painting did not begin life as Peace and Justice. Rather, it began life as Arbitration and Justice, because the Peace Palace also began life not as the seat of either the International Court of Justice or the Permanent International Court of Justice. Rather, it began life as the seat of the Permanent Court of Arbitration, and the mural titled Peace and Arbitration actually depicts an arbitration, not a court. You can see the arbitrator with the opposing counsel up in the top part of the slide. And at the bottom part of the slide, you can see the goddess of peace. She's carrying an olive branch, and her son, Cronus, the goddess of wealth, because wealth follows peace. And 2 soldiers, one with a spear, the other a sword, departing from the scene, because with arbitration, one no longer requires warfare, one no longer requires armed conflict. moving along. The focus of my remarks thus far have been very much on the United States, and rightly so. The United States played from the earliest moments of its history, as we've seen, and then subsequently throughout the 19th century, a central role in the development and use of international arbitration. But it was not solely an American affair by any means. This is a picture of Jerusalem, where arbitration was used in the earliest recorded times. During the Roman era, the Jewish communities used arbitration. They called it zabla, one each chooses one. And that too reflected the means of constituting an arbitral tribunal through the party's free will. Each party chooses one arbitrator. The two arbitrators then choose the presiding arbitrator that we've seen in almost uniformly in other historical contexts. Arbitration was also used by the Muslim communities. The Prophet Muhammad is described as using arbitration to resolve disputes both between Muslim tribes, between Muslims, and between Jewish and Muslim tribes. Arbitration playing a central role in the culture and legal infrastructure of the Middle East throughout its history. Moving along, other parts of the world equally. Arbitration used in traditional village contexts where the rule of law, state courts was incapable of providing adequate justice, both in Africa and India, all through Asia. Arbitration being used in every type of culture, every type of historical era. Moving along. And this is arbitration in Latin America, the Chamber of Commerce in Sao Paulo, where a joint venture between the American Chamber of Commerce, the New York Chamber of Commerce in the United States, and the Brazilian Stock Exchange resulted in an arbitral mechanism, which was used to resolve business disputes between Latin American and US partners early in the 20th century. Moving along. Thus far, and I warned that there might be discordant themes, thus far we've seen a consistent use of arbitration in every conceivable context. But equally, there have been alternative views. This is a quotation from a Second Circuit decision in the 1950s, which referred to one of the dark chapters in legal history. And that dark chapter, the court referred to, involved the validity and enforceability of arbitration agreements. That dark chapter can begin on the next slide with a reference to a great American jurist, a great American legal scholar, Joseph Story, Supreme Court justice of renown. And he described, though, a very different view of arbitration than we've seen thus far. He said, we all know that arbitrators at the common law possess no authority whatsoever, even to administer an oath or to compel the attendance of witnesses. They cannot compel the production of documents and papers and books of account or insist upon a discovery of facts from the parties under oath. They are not ordinarily well enough acquainted with the principles of law or equity to administer either effectually in complicated cases. And hence, it has often been said that the judgment of arbitrators is but rusticum judicium, rough justice. Moving along to the next slide, Story's view was embraced in many, not all, but in many American courts in the 19th, early 20th century. Arbitration agreements, although technically valid, were effectively unenforceable because in Story's view, although parties might agree to arbitrate, they could never actually be ordered to arbitrate. They were always free to go off to national courts and litigate their dispute if that's what they chose to do. And what would the damages for breach of the promise to arbitrate be? Well, in Story's view, and the view of a number of U.S. courts in the 19th, early 20th centuries, was the damages would be nothing because, in fact, by going to court instead of to arbitration, parties actually got something better. They weren't injured by breach of the promise to arbitrate. They were actually benefited by it, and thus there were no damages for breach of an arbitration agreement. So while technically valid, the agreement to arbitrate, the agreement to arbitrate future disputes was effectively unenforceable. Although Americans and French disagree about many things, perhaps most things, they didn't, during the 19th century, disagree about arbitration agreements. This is an excerpt from the Napoleonic Code, Article 1006 of the Commercial Code, the Civil Procedure Code, provided that an arbitration agreement would be null and void unless it specified the objects of the dispute, the subject matter of the arbitration, and the names of the arbitrators. And that provision on the next slide was interpreted in a Cour de Cassation decision from the 1840s, 1843, almost exactly the time that Joseph Story wrote the decision, issued the opinion that we saw in Toby versus County of Bristol a slide ago. The Cour de Cassation held that the Napoleonic Code made agreements to arbitrate future disputes unenforceable unless that dispute was specifically described, which of course you couldn't do because it hadn't arisen yet, and if you named the arbitrators, which of course most parties didn't want to do because the choice of the arbitrators was very much dependent on the type of dispute that might in the future arise under their contract. And thus, the result under the Napoleonic Code was very much like that under Joseph Story's understanding of arbitration in America, namely agreements to arbitrate future disputes were effectively unenforceable. Those were discordant strands in what had been a fairly uniform use of arbitration in every conceivable commercial, business, domestic relations, interstate political context over the previous 4,000 years, 4,500 years. Even in those countries, in particular in the United States, arbitration was nonetheless used effectively in many parts of the United States during the 19th century. Commercial sanctions led business people to respect their agreement to arbitrate, notwithstanding the absence of any legal mechanism to coercively enforce it. But they were indeed, as the Second Circuit properly said, they were indeed a dark chapter in both the legal history of the United States, but also in the history of arbitration that we've looked at thus far. It's time, though, to end our historical review. On the next slide, we move from the past. This is the decision in the Cour de Cassation case, for those of you that might be interested. Interestingly, the Cour de Cassation said that, arbitrators are not only a kind of second-class justice, rough justice, as Joseph Story said, but also if we upheld agreements to arbitrate future disputes, why, business people would always put arbitration agreements in their contracts, and then we courts wouldn't have much or anything left to do in the commercial context, and we certainly don't want that. Moving along to the next slide, though, and skipping over this slide to the next one, we can finish our historical review and turn to the present. This is the hearing room in the World Bank. It's not a virtual hearing, although looks a little bit like that, and if you look at it quickly, but instead a hearing in an ICSID investor state case. And that is just as the mural from the Peace Palace was the introduction to our historical review, this is the introduction to our picture of where we are today. Where we are today begins on the next slide with the Geneva Protocol on Arbitration Clauses from the 1920s, 1923. In the Geneva Protocol, the contracting states, who included many of the most important commercial jurisdictions in the 1920s, agreed that contracts between parties from each of the two contracting states submitting future disputes to arbitration would be valid. And further, that the parties to such agreements would, rather than being permitted to litigate in national courts, be referred to arbitration. Effectively, the decisions in Toby versus County of Bristol and in the Prunier versus Allianz case by the Cour de Cassation, being, at least in an international context, overridden by the protocol, the Geneva Protocol's mandate to recognize and enforce international arbitration agreements. The Geneva Convention, on the next slide, from 1927, did for international arbitral awards what the protocol did for international arbitration agreements. It made those awards valid and enforceable in all of the various contracting jurisdictions around the world. Moving to the next slide. Those two instruments, the Geneva Protocol, the Geneva Convention, were then combined in the 1950s, 1958, in a revolutionary international legal instrument, the United Nations Convention on the Recognition and Enforcement of Foreign Arbitral Awards, better known and keeping our focus on the United States today, is the New York Convention, where it was negotiated in the spring and early summer of 1958. The convention combines the protocol's obligation to recognize and enforce international arbitration agreements, that's in Article 2, and the Geneva Convention's requirement that arbitral awards be recognized subject to only narrow and specifically defined exceptions, that's Articles 3, 4, and 5. It provides, in many ways, a global constitutional charter for international commercial arbitration. At first, the convention was not terribly popular. The United States refused to sign and to ratify it for a number of years. Only in 1970 did the United States ultimately ratify the agreement and implement it, insofar as that was necessary, through the second chapter to the Federal Arbitration Act. The first states to ratify the New York Convention, going back to our look at the Middle East, were Israel, Egypt, and Syria. Keeping with the tradition of arbitration in the Middle East. Although, moving on to the next slide, arbitration and the use of the New York Convention was slow to take off after 1958, ultimately the convention became what it is today, essentially global. Iraq, the 168th state to ratify the convention, just joined last month, and save for a few outlier states, North Korea and a few other states, essentially every meaningful jurisdiction in the world is a party to the New York Convention. And it, as I said previously, provides a global constitutional charter for international commercial arbitration. The next slide shows as well the global charter for investor state arbitration. Moving on to the next slide, the ICSID Convention and its rules and regulations does for investment arbitration agreements what the New York Convention does for international commercial arbitration agreements, makes agreements to arbitrate under the ICSID Convention valid and enforceable, and provides a unique autonomous means of conducting ICSID arbitrations and provides for the recognition and enforcement of ICSID arbitral awards. Moving along. The additional facility rules expanding the availability of the ICSID Convention beyond disputes where both the investor and the host state are from ICSID Convention ratifying parties. Moving along. And ICSID itself, an arbitral institution, its headquarters at the World Bank in Washington, D.C., administering arbitrations with competence and efficiency. Moving along. The contracting parties to the ICSID Convention, not quite as many as the New York Convention, but again, essentially universal. The next slide shows us as well one means by which the use of investment arbitration became increasingly prevalent in the last decades of the 20th century. This is the first bilateral investment treaty, at least in the modern era, Germany and Pakistan, which included in it not just substantive protections for foreign investors, but also a procedural mechanism for resolving disputes between host states and foreign investors, a so-called standing offer to arbitrate. Moving along. And the number of bilateral investment treaties, which provided for investor-state arbitration, growing rapidly over time, particularly in the 1990s, early decade of this century, some 3,000 plus bilateral investment treaties, depending on how one counts, providing a network that essentially covers the entire globe with mechanisms for resolving investment disputes by international arbitration, moving along. And in a sense, that connects, if you recall, to Jay's treaty. In a sense, the disputes which prevented the Treaty of Peace between Great Britain and the United States from truly bringing peace were foreign investment disputes. Foreign creditors, British creditors, had made investments in the United States and, as a consequence of the Revolutionary War, had been unable to recoup those investments. Jay's treaty provided an arbitral mechanism by which those foreign investors who had provided capital essential to the development of the United States were able to recoup their investments. The nations around the world, moving back just one second, nations around the world also implementing the New York Convention, as well as the ICSID Convention, the Inter-American Convention on International Commercial Arbitration, through a variety of national arbitration statutes, the Incitral Model Law on International Commercial Arbitration from 1985, amended in 2006, provides a uniform means of giving effect to the New York Convention's basic requirements, as well as going on to provide an efficient means of regulating the arbitral process, provisions regarding constitution of the arbitral tribunal, provisional measures, choice of law, and the like. A statute which, if we move on now to the next slide, has been adopted in nearly 100 jurisdictions around the world, with additional states adopting some version of the model law virtually every month. The model law providing a mechanism to give effect in jurisdictions, uniform effect in jurisdictions to the New York Convention. Moving along, the United States, a little bit of an outlier here, notwithstanding its pivotal role. The United States at this point has the oldest arbitration statute, the Federal Arbitration Act from 1925, of any major jurisdiction, and virtually all minor jurisdictions. I think one Pacific island has a slightly older arbitration statute from, I think, 1904 or so. But apart from that, the United States really does have the record for the oldest arbitration statute. And as a consequence, moving on to the next slide, much of the heavy lifting in the world of arbitration in the United States has been done by courts, and particularly in the international context, U.S. courts have, at least historically, played a significant role in the development of international commercial arbitration. The Mitsubishi, one can name a number of decisions, the BG Group versus Republic of Argentina decision from a couple years ago, an obvious example, but the Mitsubishi versus Solar Chrysler Plymouth decision in 1985, perhaps being the most obvious, the most important example, where the Supreme Court held that although domestic arbitration agreements to resolve antitrust disputes by arbitration were unenforceable, that was not true in an international context, where an arbitration agreement was subject to the New York Convention, then a different rule applied, and antitrust, international antitrust disputes were not non-arbitrable. Even though the New York Convention might have permitted the United States to have treated such disputes as non-arbitrable, the Supreme Court, in language that you can see on the slide, which was robustly pro-arbitration, refused to conclude that Congress had intended to make international antitrust disputes non-arbitrable. It emphasized the importance of arbitration to resolve international commercial disputes, but said the potential of these tribunals for efficient disposition of legal disagreements arising from commercial relations has not yet been tested. If they are to take a central place in the international legal order, national courts must shake off the old judicial hostility to arbitration, remember Joseph's story, and also their customary and understandable unwillingness to cede jurisdiction of a claim arising under domestic law to a foreign or transnational tribunal to this extent, at least it will be necessary for national courts to subordinate domestic notions of arbitrability to the international policy favoring commercial arbitration. It would be difficult to pen a more robust affirmation of international commercial arbitration. And the court's faith in the arbitral process was mirrored by national courts in other jurisdictions that have relied on cited Mitsubishi and their own thinking on international arbitration. And by today, as we're going to see in a few moments, arbitration has indeed taken its place, as the court said, taken a central place in the international legal order. Moving on to the next slide. It has done so. Arbitration has taken that place in part through the use of arbitral institutions. Virtually every country, not just the United States with the AAA, you can see its logo there, JAMS and others. But in virtually every jurisdiction around the world, arbitral institutions being developed to bring professionalism, bring consistency to the arbitral process, particularly in international commercial arbitrations, as well as investment arbitrations. Moving along, it's not just, and one can also look at the caseload statistics at different arbitral institutions around the world and the progressive and fairly startling increase in the caseloads at leading arbitral institutions. At the Singapore International Arbitration Center, where, as Rika mentioned, I have the privilege of serving as president, we have gone from a caseload in the early 1990s of less than a dozen cases to last year, 2020, a caseload of more than 1,050 cases submitted to SIC arbitration. And although that may be a bit more robust than some other institutions, it's emblematic of the use of arbitration in the 21st century to resolve commercial disputes. Arbitration is not just popular, moving on to the next slide, by way of numbers. It's used to resolve every conceivable type of disputes, whether shipping and maritime disputes, intellectual property disputes, mining and infrastructure projects, agriculture, commodities disputes, banking, financial services disputes, sports disputes, every conceivable type of dispute, just as historically was the case, is submitted to international commercial arbitration. Moving along, it's not just large companies, although large companies do actively use international arbitration, but also smaller entrepreneurs, merchants, farmers, and the like use arbitration because of the advantages that it brings. Moving along, this, and we'll move very quickly through these slides. This is the Court of Arbitration for Sport in Lausanne. Without the Court of Arbitration for Sport, in some ways, one couldn't have the Olympics, at least not in the way that we are accustomed to. It resolves in a uniform, international, neutral, and expert means sports disputes, including disputes at the Olympics when there needs to be a decision in literally hours. Its caseload, unsurprisingly, and you can see the numbers on the current slide, has dramatically increased over the years. The same is true, moving on to the next slide, of intellectual property disputes. Like sports disputes 40 years ago or so, intellectual property disputes were never arbitrated. In many countries, they were non-arbitrable. But there's been a sea change. Under the auspices of the World Intellectual Property Organization, there's a specialized arbitral mechanism, WIPO arbitral mechanism, which only resolves intellectual property disputes. And these days, significant numbers of intellectual property disputes are not just arbitrable, but they are arbitrated. Moving along, the same is true of investor-state arbitration. Back in the early days of ICSID, the early 1970s, a caseload that bumped along at a couple cases a year. Now, nearly 800 ICSID arbitrations having been conducted since 1972. Moving along. And arbitration being used not just to resolve numerous disputes and not just all kinds, all manner of subject matters, but also being used in many ways to resolve the world's most important disputes. If one pays attention to the business pages, but also to the front pages addressing political matters, whether it's the South China Sea, whether it's Philip Morris against Uruguay and investor state arbitration, whether it's resolving territorial border disputes in Africa or Asia or elsewhere, whether it's just ordinary, normal, routine arbitration between businesses that want to put their disputes to rest. Arbitration is used to resolve both the most important and the least important of the disputes that humankind has in the 21st century. Moving along. But notwithstanding that, and that's a fairly positive picture of arbitration today, we're still in the present, there have been in the last decades conflicting views. This is an excerpt of the Andean Commission's decision on foreign capital, which, reminiscent of the Calvo Clause, held that agreements to submit investment disputes to jurisdictions other than means of dispute resolution, other than local courts in the host state, were invalid, null and void. That view, moving on, was decisively rejected in the 3,300 bilateral investment treaties that we looked at in the ICSID Convention, which is nearly global, but it wasn't rejected in all law schools. This is the so-called Osgood Declaration from 2010, which, and I'll paraphrase here, which provided that investor state arbitration was fundamentally illegitimate because it resulted in states losing sometimes, because its procedures were illegitimate in the sense that they were not public, that they were private in some manner. Private lawyers, private business people, private law professors sat as arbitrators rather than national courts, and there was no appellate mechanism. And as a consequence, the law professors that subscribed to the Osgood Declaration urged that states carefully reconsider and indeed reject the use of investor state arbitration. At first, that statement got little, that declaration had little traction, but over time it found ready audiences in different parts of the world. The next slide shows one of those audiences. This is Hugo Chavez, and if we look on the next slide, we can see exactly what he was saying there, rejecting the notion that having lost arbitrations, ICSID arbitrations, that Venezuela would ever pay the awards in those arbitrations, almost exactly the opposite view of that taken by Great Britain in the Alabama arbitration, notwithstanding a substantial award against it. It was not just Hugo Chavez, but elsewhere in Latin America, Bolivia, Ecuador, and in particular, rejecting the use of investor state arbitration. The next slide shows as well that this was not confined to Latin America. In Russia, legislation being adopted, which didn't exactly render agreements to arbitrate invalid, but which provided a fairly loosely defined category of corporate disputes, which could only be arbitrated under the rules of an institution approved by the Russian Federation, a slightly different formulation of what was essentially the Calvo Doctrine for a specific type of disputes. But moving out of investment arbitration proper to commercial arbitration. And then, of course, as is well known in this country, moving on to the next slide, Donald Trump rejecting the investor state mechanisms and NAFTA, refusing to enter into or continue negotiations of the TPP, and ultimately renegotiation of what was NAFTA to significantly curtail, moving on to the next slide, significantly curtail the use of investor state arbitration. To some extent, perhaps more bark than bite, given the availability of other means than NAFTA for protection of foreign investments, but nonetheless, a significant backtracking of use of investor state arbitration by one of the countries, the United States, which was at the forefront of the development of investor state arbitration. Moving on to the next slide. And this is not the European Parliament, this is the European Court of Justice. And on the following slide, we have the European Court of Justice's sort of mirror image, if I can put it that way, to Donald Trump's view of investor state arbitration in NAFTA. The ACME decision providing that with respect to intra, at least some types of intra EU bilateral investment treaties, European law purportedly rendered those agreements ineffective. The validity of that decision as a matter of international law is hotly debated, but it nonetheless reflected a view of arbitration dramatically different from that taken by the Supreme Court in the Mitsubishi case, where the U.S. Supreme Court, as we discussed previously, held that international arbitral tribunals were competent to interpret and apply mandatory U.S. antitrust law principles. The ECJ, the European Court of Justice, held that only it was competent to apply European mandatory law rules and that arbitral tribunals, including investment tribunals, might not be moving along. And subsequently, in a fairly extraordinary international agreement, the European Union terminating retroactively, at least purportedly, bilateral investment treaties between EU member states. Moving along and skipping over the next slide. And just going back to a point that I made previously about how these discordant themes were not confined solely to investment arbitration, in the speech by Lord Thomas, the senior judicial officer in the United Kingdom, who in terms that really could have come out of the Court of Cassation's mouth in 1843, questioned the use of, at least some uses of international commercial and domestic commercial arbitration in the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom also, like the United States, having played a central role in the development of international arbitration, according to Lord Thomas, because so many parties want to arbitrate, there won't be enough cases for the development of the common law by the UK Supreme Court, by the UK courts generally. It's a little surprising given the rising caseloads in those jurisdictions and the important role that arbitral awards can play in the development of commercial practices, but it nonetheless reflects one of those discordant views that one has seen at time to time historically. And let's move along. That brings us, you'll be happy to know because we're getting a little tight on time, to the future. This is a famous painting of George Washington, consistent with our focus on the United States, America. It's on our currency. It's unfinished, though, a little bit like the future. And what I want to do in the remaining minutes that I have is to try to look at the future and to think in particular about which of these two views of arbitration, international arbitration, will prevail in the future and what we ought to do in light of that. One view is the view consistently taken for 4,600 years, beginning in southern Iraq, Mesopotamia, and continuing through the Middle East, through classical antiquity, through the Middle Ages in Europe, through Africa, China, Latin America, through, in particular, the United States, of business people and others, perhaps those writing last wills and testaments, perhaps those statesmen like Elihu Root, using arbitration in every era to resolve every type of dispute. The other view is that of the Napoleonic Code and Hugo Chavez, Donald Trump, Elizabeth Warren. That view is that arbitration is a second-class form of justice that undermines the democratic process on the one hand and the rule of law on the other hand, that it's in some fundamental sense illegitimate. And what I want to do in the time remaining is to consider that challenge and that choice, which of those two views of arbitration will, which should prevail. The next slide provides how I want to go about that. This is an excerpt from a Quebec appellate decision and it's important. I want to focus right now not on the first sentence, which we're going to come back to and which is quite important, but rather the second sentence. Arbitration should be perceived as a means of alternative dispute resolution that, depending on the circumstances, achieves certain goals pursued by the parties, e.g. speed, decision by peers, cost efficiency, etc. I think we can refer to those very pragmatic goals, those pragmatic advantages, as the five or the six E's of arbitration. I'll go through them really quickly, but arbitration is preferred because it's more efficient, more expeditious, more expert, more even-handed, more enforceable, and today, with virtual hearings, more electronic than national court proceedings. We've seen echoes or foreshadowing of each one of these various E's and all the materials that we've gone through in the last 40 minutes or so. But let's look just quickly at some of them. Let's start with, on the next slide, efficiency and expedition. We saw references to that everywhere, from the New York Post boy to Gerard Beline's treatise on the Lex Mercatoria. But today, arbitral institutions of the sort that I've described previously have really elevated expedition to an art form. These are the expedited procedure rules from the Singapore International Arbitration Center. Those rules permit fast-track dispute resolution in less than 6 months of smaller value disputes, typically by a sole arbitrator. Other institutions, as we can see on the next slide, the ICC in particular, have adopted similar expedited procedure rules. Expedition, of course, brings to an end business disputes which otherwise interfere with commercial activities. It also adds expense. Time is money, of course, and so by expediting disputes, arbitration also brings efficient resolution of disputes, particularly compared to national court proceedings. The third of the E's on the next slide is expertise. The president of the Court of Cassation, not the Court of Cassation back in 1843, but instead at the end of the 20th century, put it really nicely. First, and he was discussing why arbitration was a good thing in contemporary France. What you do, we don't have to do, relieves the caseloads in national courts. And in many fields, you are more professional than we are. And that really summarizes that arbitrators selected after a dispute has arisen are selected by the parties because of their expertise in a particular subject matter, because they really know about telecoms joint ventures in the Middle East or insurance policies between British insurers and American insureds or whatever the subject matter of the dispute is, as opposed to being a jack of all trades who must resolve tax disputes, criminal disputes, administrative law disputes, constitutional law disputes, landlord-tenant disputes, and maybe just occasionally a dispute remotely like something that the parties actually bring to him or her. And then moving to the next slide, others having captured this. This is Clarence Darrow, who, in describing his life at the law, waxes eloquently about how arbitration is superior to national court proceedings. There are always some members on the board, the arbitration tribunal, as he was referring to in the context of labor arbitration, who know something about the matters involved, while a court is supposed not to know. In fact, a judge must not know, even if he does know. And then in a court, every important issue may be thrown by the wind on account of the most senseless law or a crotchet of a judge. Clarence Darrow was a little undiplomatic in that description, but the more important point is that arbitration is necessarily more expert because of the party's role, the parties who know best what their dispute concerns and have the greatest incentive to ensure that it's resolved in an expert and sensible fashion, are the ones who choose the arbitrators when they know what that dispute actually entails, as opposed to random arbitrary selection of a jack of all trades. Moving along. And this is a slightly more sensitive topic, but arbitration is also more even-handed. It's particularly in international matters, more even-handed because rather than litigating in either or frequently both parties' home courts, Arbitration allows the resolution of disputes in a neutral forum, an international forum, where neither party is disadvantaged by being on the other party's home turf. But there's a further point that is more troubling in some ways. This is an excerpt from Transparency International. It's from 2007, but the statistics for the next 14 years as of today are identical. It records the frequency of corruption in judicial proceedings in various jurisdictions around the world. I'll leave for you to look at the numbers, but they are shocking. The extent of corruption in judicial proceedings in many parts of the world is truly alarming. You get quite literally what you pay for in a good number of national courts. And as a consequence, arbitration, where there have been virtually no instances of corruption and where the parties police the choice of the members of the tribunal, presents a much more even-handed mechanism for resolving disputes. That's especially true if we move on to the next slide. When you have disputes with states or state-owned entities, this is from Judicial Independence, and it records with light-colored countries being quite independent and other countries being the more red-hued jurisdictions being less independent. It demonstrates a striking lack of judicial independence in many parts of the world. It's a World Bank publication. And again, arbitrators have the independence, the impartiality and the independence required by the New York Convention and the UNCTRAL model law that is lacking in so many courts around the world. Moving on to the next slide and getting close to wrapping up. The fifth E that I mentioned was enforceability. No parallel to the New York Convention and the UNCTRAL model law, which make both international arbitration agreements and arbitral awards fully portable with an enforceability premium as compared to choice of court provisions and national court judgments. Of course, the Hague Choice of Court Agreement convention being muted, but when one looks at the terms of that convention, there's good reason that very, very few countries have acceded to the convention. And one can certainly hope, if you look carefully at the convention, that other countries do not do so. It is an unfortunate step in the private international law context. Moving along. Those five E's thus far explain the pragmatic benefits, advantages of arbitration, and give one, hopefully, cause for optimism about the future. The sixth E, of course, is that arbitration is more electronic. Virtual hearings, which, like this lecture, are conducted easily, technologically, seamlessly, have proceeded apace. Arbitral institutions are recording record numbers of disputes, notwithstanding the pandemic. And I think it's fair to say that in virtually all jurisdictions, arbitration has weathered the pandemic storm a good deal better than proceedings in national courts. And it's unsurprisingly for that reason that the institutional caseloads that we looked at have continued to increase very, very significantly. In a sense, what the Court of Cassation said in Prunier is right. If you enforce agreements to arbitrate, then businesses are going to use arbitration to resolve their disputes. But I want to focus not on those pragmatic benefits of arbitration, but instead on the first couple sentences of what the Quebec Court of Appeal decision that we looked at previously said. And that is the following. Arbitration is a fundamental right of citizens and an expression of their contractual freedom. It should not be considered as an infringement upon the monopoly of state judgment. Let's move on to the next slide, but think about what the Court of Appeals said there. In many ways, it's precisely what Gerard Malan said back in 1622. Arbitration is a matter of arbitrium or free will, whence the name arbitrator is resolved. Arbitration is something which is voluntary and in the party's own power. Free democratic societies, although under pressure in many parts of the world, remain dominant, and rightly so. Fundamental to free democratic societies is the right of citizens, ordinary people, businesses, to structure their lives, their relationships as they choose. Whether it's freedom of marriage, freedom of conscience, freedom of movement, freedom of contract, fundamental to a democratic society, to a free society characterized by respect for civil rights, is the right of citizens to form relationships, those relationships which they choose, and to structure those relationships in the way that they think brings them the most happiness. Every relationship, though, every human relationship, whether it's a marriage, a contract, a treaty between two states, is, because it's only human, certain to have disagreements. Just as fundamental as the right of autonomy to structure relationships is the right to mend relationships, the right to cure the flaws, the illnesses in relationships which ultimately arise, and the right in particular of people, as Gerard Malign says, the right of free citizens to resolve their disputes by arbitration, by not just a means that they choose, but by the arbitrators that they choose, the Hebrew concept of zabla, the mechanism for constituting arbitral tribunals that has been used through the ages. That is an essential aspect of a democratic society, an essential aspect of basic human rights. It's not illegitimate, and it doesn't undermine the rule of law. It's fundamental to the rule of law. It's part of the rule of law. Let's look at the other side of the coin, though. Let's look at the next slide and consider how the opponents of arbitration have treated it over the years. This is the Reich's directives from the National Socialist government shortly after the Reichstag fires in 1933 in Nazi Germany. The Nazis, after ascending to power, took over the German judiciary with only Nazi-chosen judges. Of course, Aryans, others need not and could not apply. And exactly the same thing was done with arbitration, but more so. The Nazis forbid any state entity from entering into arbitration agreements, issued directives giving state entities, state-owned companies, the right retroactively to annul arbitration agreements, required all arbitrators to be state-approved and Aryan. They viewed arbitration, if we move on to the next slide, as a threat to the National Socialist view of society. They saw it as undermining the Nazi world order. It was a threat, not a basic human right. Germany has changed fundamentally over the past 40, 50 years. This is a decision from 1963, the German Federal Labor Court, which said exactly the opposite, which, following Gerard Malines, repudiated the 1933 Reich's directives and said the decision to submit a matter to arbitration is contained in the fundamental right to freedom of contract under Article 2 of the German Basic Law, the German Constitution. Affirming, the, as we discussed previously, how fundamentally important the right to mend your relationship, the right to resolve your disputes by arbitration is in a free and democratic society. The same view was taken, if we move on to the next slide. And this is the second article of the German Constitution guaranteeing German citizens the right to free development, autonomous development of their own lives, their own personality, which the court invoked. Moving on to the next slide. You'll recall our discussion of the Napoleonic Code, which essentially invalidated agreements to arbitrate future disputes. But as we can see on the next slide, there was, in fact, an earlier chapter. This is from the Constitution of Year One, the French Republic. And among the constitutional rights, together with liberty, equality, and fraternity, was the right to arbitrate. Article 86 of the the Constitution of Year One guaranteed the right of citizens to resolve disputes by arbitrators of their own choice, a deliberate recognition of the right of citizens not to have their disputes resolved by state judges selected by the monarchs, but instead by arbitrators who they, the citizens themselves, chose. Next slide, please. And that approach, the French Republic's approach rather than the Napoleonic Code's approach, was emphatically embraced by French courts following World War II. One could list numerous decisions. Here's just one example, the Dalico case, among literally hundreds of pro-arbitration decisions rendered by French courts. Next slide, please. And we'll go very quickly through the final slides and then conclude. Other courts around the world in the last decades having recognized precisely the same thing, a Brazilian court. Arbitration does not subtract any constitutional guarantees from domestic proceedings. Instead, it fulfills constitutional rights, essentially what the German Federal Labor Court said. In the next slide, very much the same view from the Panamanian Supreme Court. And moving on to the next slide. And this is our final quotation, a Hawaiian court. The autonomy of parties to enter into an arbitration agreement is directly correlated to and stems from the constitutionally protected right of freedom of contract. At the end of the day, which of these two competing views, the Osgood Declaration on the one hand, or the Quebec Court of Appeal, the Hawaiian state court decision here of arbitration, will should prevail? Certainly, the view that arbitration is a fundamental human right, the view shared by the German Federal Labor Court, French courts, US courts, other courts around the world, is what should prevail. Citizens have the right not just to form relationships, but also to mend them. And arbitration is the way that for 4,600 years, people from every part of the world, every language, every religion have chosen to do so. That doesn't undermine the rule of law. It is the rule of law. It's a fundamentally important aspect of the rule of law. The other view, the dark chapter, the chapters that we've seen in the Napoleonic Code and in the Nazi directives of 1933, hopefully is not the view of the future. It shouldn't be. We can't say for sure, if we move on to the last slide, exactly how that painting will be completed. But I think George Washington's affirmation of arbitration in his last will and testament is probably the best indicator of where, at least for America, the future will be. Arbitration will remain a central part of our legal order. At least let's hope so. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary, for that captivating walk through a few millennia of history of arbitration. Before we break for our networking session, I wanted to turn the lens to the audience, and in particular to the diverse group of arbitration practitioners from around the world who have so kindly joined us this evening for the presentation. And we've heard your account of the countervailing views of arbitration, both in the past and present, as well as in some of your other speeches, a call to arms issued to the arbitration community. To protect and strengthen our practice from critics and from state interference. I'd be interested to know if you think your call has been heeded, and if so, what has worked well and what could we as an arbitration community do better?
That's a good question. And perhaps I'm not the most objective, the most even-handed, if I can use that term, of responders to the question. I think not really that my call has been heeded. I think that would focus too much on the call. I think the better way to put it would be that the last years, the last several years have seen international arbitration up its game materially. I think performance of arbitral institutions, of the arbitration community during the pandemic has been remarkable. If you had told people 5 years ago that all hearings were, or essentially all hearings were going to be conducted remotely, all filings were going to be made electronically, witnesses would be cross-examined, not just on the odd, unusual occasion, virtually, but always, I don't think anybody would have believed you. Institutions, though, some with foresight, like the Korean Commercial Arbitration Board, met the challenges of remote hearings, and arbitration practitioners and also parties, businesses all around the world adapted to a fundamentally different environment and adapted using many of the techniques that characterize arbitration: flexibility, focusing on efficiency, working together cooperatively, not always, obviously, but in a remarkable number of cases. I can certainly say from my own practice, although there's inevitably skirmishing about will you have, won't you have a virtual hearing, what will it look like? In the vast majority of cases, the parties actually come to some sort of agreement, and when they don't, the tribunal manages the process surprisingly well. I wouldn't say it's just that as well, though. I think the expedited procedure rules that I referred to that began with the Singapore International Arbitration Center, but that have been picked up everywhere, the development of emergency arbitration, a creature of the last 15 years or so, the increasing use of early dismissal pioneered by ICSID, but now also used elsewhere, all of those are quite important procedural innovations. No single one is a silver bullet, a magic wand, but all of them have contributed incrementally to arbitration upping its game, I think. I think it needs to continue to do that. I think the forces, the resurgence in a sense of the dark chapter, who see arbitration as a threat to national control, to state control over all aspects of human life, are resurgent, not diminishing. And I think we will continue to face challenges, both incremental challenges, criticizing aspects of the arbitral process, but underlying many of those criticisms, a fundamental antipathy to the private resolution of disputes.
Staying on the topic of the extraordinary times that we're in, and frankly, the revolution in virtual hearings that we've seen over the past year, what have you seen, both as an arbitrator and as an advocate, that's worked particularly well, and conversely, things that perhaps have not panned out quite as well as people may have hoped?
I think the platforms that I suspect nobody had heard of 2 years ago, I never heard of Zoom or Blue Jeans, at least not the familiar virtual Blue Jean. I think those have really, the technology has really been quite impressive. I think the technology providers for remote access to documents and sort of shared access, a little bit like the slides today, have also worked quite well. I think the people have worked well in the sense that although there's obviously guerrilla tactics in many, many disputes at some point, guerrilla tactics of a sort or simple stubbornness. I think actually the community has worked very well together. I think a potential area where things might not work so well is national court treatment of awards resulting from remote hearings. I think the early returns are quite positive. The decisions pre-pandemic about remote testimony, both decisions in the US, but also Australia, elsewhere, were all quite positive. I think early indications are mostly positive, but I've heard, and I'm sure others have as well, snippets of reports from different places that courts may not recognize awards that have resulted from from virtual hearings, and I think that would be a real failure. One, you know, with the resurgent forces of nationalism, one can anticipate that there may be incidents of that, but hopefully they'll be very limited.
Yeah, it's been interesting for practitioners watching how different tribunals, to the extent this is publicly reported, how different tribunals are navigating this issue and doing everything they can to ensure that all due process rights are respected. So staying on the topic of national courts, I wanted to posit a question that's come from the audience, which is whether you consider that the advantages of the enforcement of awards under the New York Convention and the model law extend to interim awards and measures issued by international arbitrators?
It's a great question. We could have a whole separate webinar on that question. I think what's meant by interim awards would be awards granting interim relief or provisional / conservatory measures. And there is a diversity of opinion on this. Some courts, Australian courts, for example, have held that an award granting provisional relief, interim relief, isn't in fact an award. It's not an award for purposes of the New York Convention, therefore needn't be recognized under the convention. Conversely, can't be enforced under the convention. U.S. courts have historically taken a very different view. They have held that awards of interim relief are indeed awards, that they're meant to resolve a specific discrete part of the case, and also final in the sense that they're meant to resolve it at least till the end of the arbitration. And in life, nothing is perfect, so that's final enough for purposes of both the FAA and the New York Convention. The whole debate between those two views is complicated a little bit by emergency arbitration awards, because one can add to that the question, well, is an emergency arbitrator even an arbitrator if what she does is necessarily limited to 60, 90, however many days the emergency arbitrator's mandate may be. My own view is twofold. First, I think American courts, not Australian courts, have got it right. One should treat awards of interim relief as awards for purposes of both the convention, the model law, and otherwise. The model law in its 2006 amendments, and this is my second point, sort of partly addresses this by providing a standalone mechanism for giving effect to awards of interim relief through Article 17 as opposed to through Articles 35, 30. And the final recognition provisions of the model law. And I think that's another way to approach the problem that's worthwhile. If, however, national law hasn't specifically addressed the issue, I think the first point that I made, it may be interim, but it's still an award, is the right view. I think I'm probably, though, in a minority on that particular view. I think if you polled treatise writers and national courts around the world, there would be strength in numbers on the other side of the aisle.
I wish I knew how to use the polling mechanism very quickly on Zoom so we could see what our audience thinks. We've got a very diverse set of practitioners here, so it'd be interesting to hear their views.
Yeah.
I'd like to posit one more question from the audience. Which is, to your point about states' hesitancy to adopt investor-state arbitration, is there a place for mandatory ethics rules for adjudicators in ISDS?
Well, that's a good question. It's a very timely question, of course, because UNCITRAL and ICSID, using exactly that phrase, are developing a code of conduct for mandatory code of conduct, if I understand it, although there's so many brackets, it's hard, for adjudicators, which I think would include not just arbitrators, but mediators and others. I've always taken the view that ethics in arbitration for both counsel and arbitrators doesn't suffer from too few rules, but too many rules. It's not the no man's land where there are no signposts. It's the teenager's bedroom where there are five or six different discordant sources of sound. And I think that's unhelpful because when you have multiple sources of legal rules, you actually don't really have legal rules. You have confusion and a recipe for disputes and litigation. If there were a mechanism, either for investor state or commercial arbitration, for there to be a uniform set of rules for counsel on the one hand and arbitrators on the other hand, I think that would be a good thing. I think it would be surprisingly more doable than I believe many people assume at first instance. I think it's imminently undoable to adopt a truly international code of conduct for lawyers in all cases. That's been proven by the difficulties in the European Union and the difficulties in other contexts. However, if one focused simply on rules of conduct for counsel on the one hand, arbitrators on the other, agreed by major jurisdictions where arbitration is important. I think of United States, England, France, Switzerland, Singapore, other jurisdictions, of course. I don't mean to leave anybody out, but jurisdictions that are major players in international arbitration, I think that might actually be doable, perhaps with some gray areas or ambiguity or whatnot. And I do think that would be a good thing. I'm not sure, I have to say, having seen the effort that Unsetral and ICSID have made thus far, that is likely to be the result. I don't see how that will, I guess it can apply within ICSID arbitration itself. I don't see how it has a more universal application. And just looking at the drafts, I worry about how exactly those rules will be developed as a substantive matter and whether they will be constructive or not constructive on the other hand. I think it's too early to say, but I think there's cause for concern.
And what role would you envision the arbitral institutions, if any, in playing in encouraging or implementing a more universal set of ethical norms, whether from guidance or increased transparency initiatives or other methods?
I think that's a really good point, and it is important. The Swiss Arbitration Association some years ago sought to create an international dialogue between different arbitral institutions that ultimately was shelved about counsel conduct, not about arbitrator ethics. That ultimately was, for better or for worse, shelved. I think the way that I could see an initiative like this developing would be a shared platform between leading arbitral institutions on the one hand and leading bar associations. Coincidentally, this is sponsored by two committees of the City Bar Association, New York City Bar Association. So maybe this is a good suggestion. I could see a joint effort by leading bar associations and leading arbitral institutions to address questions of counsel ethics. I think there's a real possibility that there could be agreement within the very limited purview of international arbitration on basic counsel rules, even though you can't get agreement on a much wider scale. I think arbitral institutions have a very important role to play in that, because although I never realized it until I became the president of the Court of Arbitration at SIC, by being inside an institution, you have a whole different view of arbitration and you see many different things, a lot more things, although in a different way, and it's an important perspective.
I don't want to intrude too much on your time this evening, and also want to leave time for the networking session, which I know the audience is very eager to participate in. But Gary, I wanted to thank you so much for this really invigorating presentation and for taking our questions from the audience. And thank you to the audience members for your participation and submission of questions. And it's been a real pleasure this evening.
No, thank you, Aaron. And thank everyone in the audience as well. It was a real pleasure.
We can try everyone launching the poll and see how it goes to the question of the extension. If you'd right. like to answer it.
I see. Hosts and panelists are excluded.
Oh, I'm not allowed to vote.
No. This is just a delegate question. So, a few more coming in. Okay. Let me publish the results. There it is.
All right.
Oh, wow. I don't know. I think I unfairly biased it in my presentation of the question, but I'm glad to see that result.
And with that, join me please in thanking both Gary and Aaron, and we will proceed via separate link to the networking if you can join us. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks again, everybody.
Good night.